Blog Talk Radio.
Hold it now. Talk Productions, one of the few Black-owned radio stations that addresses solutions in the Black community, presents Black Urban America. Now, all you folks that listen by laptop, if you want to join the conversation by making a comment or have a question for our upcoming guest, the number is 516-531-9540. That's 516-531-9540. And press 1 if you want to make a statement or ask a question. Now, the lineup, as every week, Tuesday, you have myself, and my name is Kenneth Jones, host of Black Urban America. On Wednesday evening, you have The Cutting Edge with Michonne Williams. On Thursday, you have The Part of Harlem Magazine with Mr. Wayne Young. And on Saturday, you have Provocative Thought with Carlton Steve. All shows begin at 8 o'clock p.m. Tonight, we have a guest. They call her the Science Voice. She is the professor of microbiology and molecular genetics at Emory University. Also, she is the state health representative for District 108 in Georgia when she is running for election this year. And finally, she is the director of the Georgia Alliance for Social Justice. I want everybody to welcome Dr. Jasmine Clark. Dr. Clark, welcome.
Hi. Good evening. Thank you for that, and thank you for the introduction. I do want to make one clarification. I am no longer a director of the Georgia Alliance for Social Justice. I was one of the directors, the community outreach director, but when I got elected, I no longer worked with the Georgia Alliance for Social Justice, and instead I took my activism to inside of the Capitol as a legislator.
Okay, thank you for clearing that up. So you're a scientist that worked with, well, used to be a scientist that worked with microscopic organisms such as bacteria that deal with single cell and their domain. In short, explain how that whole research process in studying various bacteria.
Sure. So I study microbiology. Currently, I'm not in the lab. I have pretty much put my focus on teaching microbiology at the college level, but I am a published scientist. My microorganism of choice was actually viruses, and I studied retroviruses. And so what I did was I took very, very expensive but high efficiency microscopes that are able to look inside of cells while the cells are still alive. And I was able to look at how viruses use those cells in order to get around in the cells. So I was basically doing some tracking of particles, and those particles were virus particles. So it was an interesting project. I am published. I have published two scientific articles on my work, and I have been cited numerous times by other articles as well. And so in a nutshell, microbiology is all about the microscopic world. It's actually a fairly new science in that we just discovered that there were microorganisms all around us a few hundred years ago. So it's an emerging science. We are learning new things every day, and I am happy to contribute to the sciences in any way that I can. I do a little bit of very small bit of research, and I am actually working on a paper now that studies the microbes that live in our bodies. That's kind of a side project that I'm doing along with teaching and legislating in Georgia.
Wow. Well, that should keep you busy. Isn't that something? You go from dealing with one type of organism to dealing with another type of organism in the legislature house. How did you come to becoming a politician, a career politician? From a scientist to a politician. You know, we hear lawyers become a politicians. We hear educators become a politicians. But that's usually when scientists are involved in politics, they're usually appointed. But you just went into the whole campaign of being a politician. What made you do that?
Well, to be honest, this all kind of started with Donald Trump when he pretty much when he got in office, one of the first things that he did was he kind of really went after the science community, specifically climate science. But even though I'm not a climate scientist, I did take it personally how he kind of went after science in general, academia, intellectualism, and really kind of attacked people who spend their life and their life's work trying to contribute to the body of science and the body of knowledge of the way things work around us. And so that kind of triggered something in me. It did not necessarily trigger me to want to become a politician, but it did kind of trigger that activism side of me. And mm-hmm. so that is how I got involved with the first thing that I did was I led a March for Science in Atlanta, Georgia. It was one of many satellite marches in the name of the March for Science in 2017 on Earth Day. We had them all across the globe, and I was democratically chosen to be the leader of the one in Atlanta. And so after that, that really awoken something. It really got me to realize just how much people care about these things and how much people want leaders that will listen to them and listen to the science. And, you know, no one could have predicted that we were going to have a pandemic 2 years after I became elected. But in this time, I think we see even more why it's important to listen to the science, trust the science, or at least acknowledge the science. When you're dealing with something that's affecting so many people's lives and taking so many people's lives. And so I got to this by a very unconventional route. You know, I loved my science. I loved my microscopes. And then I went from, you know, microscopically looking at viruses and tracking viruses and cells to microscopically looking at bills and looking at the way that we are legislating here in Georgia and the policies that we are putting in place and the way they affect people's lives and the lives of Georgians across the state.
Yeah, I just want to say this. There's a lot of virus in that state capital. Now, can you explain District 108, Gwinnett, which includes Gwinnett County? Explain that environment and demographics of Gwinnett County in Georgia.
Absolutely. So Gwinnett County itself is the second largest county in Georgia. We probably have over 1 million people, but as of the last census, we were just under 1 million people with about 950,000 people in our county. It's a pretty large county geographically, and demographically, it is one of the most diverse counties in the country. I mean, we have hundreds of countries represented. tens of languages represented. I mean, we really are a melting pot of cultures, of diversity, of races, ethnicities, religions, ages, just life experiences. It is really, truly a diverse county. And House District 108, which is in the southern portion of Gwinnett County, right up against DeKalb County, which is another large metro Atlanta county. House District 108 includes the city of Lilburn and surrounding areas of Norcross, Tucker, Stone Mountain, and Lawrenceville, and as well is one of the most diverse areas in the state of Georgia. In fact, one of the elementary schools that's within the district is one of the most diverse elementary schools in the country. So we are, you know, we are beautifully diverse and beautifully colorful, and I love my environment. I love that any neighborhood that you live in, it's going to be pretty heterogeneous. You're not going to find homogeneous neighborhoods where everyone thinks the same or looks the same. You're going to find people from all over the world speaking all different languages, all within the same neighborhoods, and so it's amazing.
In your first term, there were two areas that dominated your campaign. One was health care and the other was reproductive rights. Why is that?
Well, healthcare, and the interesting thing about your question is I think that healthcare and reproductive rights are actually one and the same, in that reproductive rights is healthcare. But healthcare is important to me because when I speak to people, when I speak to Georgians about healthcare, that is the thing that is really on their mind. You know, if you have insurance, I have constituents that have insurance right now, and they have what they would consider good insurance through their employer, and they are still having trouble paying their medical bills. So imagine how the people in my district who do not have health insurance feel. I have constituents that are afraid to go to the doctor, and in fact, they are more afraid of going to the doctor and the bill that will come from that doctor visit than they are of getting seriously ill or even dying. There are people who turn down ambulance rides and people who will not go to the emergency room unless someone forces them or they have to be taken to the emergency room because there's no other choice because they do not want to get the bill. There are people who are sick, and then when they go to CVS or Walgreens or to the Publix pharmacy to pick up their prescriptions, they are they get sticker shock. They need this medicine. They literally cannot afford it. You know, medicine's costing $300, $400, $500. That's not realistic for a lot of people. And so these are the things that I was hearing, and this is something to me, in my opinion, that is, it is 2020. It is absolutely unnecessary and inhumane that we are still treating people this way. I really truly believe that healthcare should be a right, and it should be something that everyone has access to. That should be a non-starter. We're in a developed country. There's no reason for people to be more afraid of their medical bill than they are of cancer, or they are of diabetes, or they are of something that could be treated early, but they wait until they are so ill that they have no other choice but to go to the doctor. And then by then, it's even more expensive than it would have been if they would have went to the doctor earlier.
Right. I'm going to move away from healthcare for a second, and I'm going to come back to healthcare.
Okay.
One of the bills that you sponsored your first term is the bill that addressed one educational issue. It's access to higher education for DACA children and foster care children, which is great. But I just want to know, the language of the bill does not have the language of Black children included. Can you explain to me why?
So the right now, if you are a Georgia resident and you are, if you are Black, no matter what race you are, if you are a Georgia resident and you are a citizen, then you get in-state tuition to a Georgia state school. So UGA, Georgia Tech, you know, things like that, Georgia State, you get in-state tuition. But that right now is not extended to DACA recipients. So if you are a DACA recipient, even if you've been in our school since kindergarten and you have gone to school with all the other people who are getting in-state tuition for the last 12 years or however long DACA has been going on, I lose track of the actual time frame, you are still considered out of state. And you're only considered out of state because you came here as a child undocumented. And to me, it doesn't make any sense. It is actually a pretty fiscally irresponsible policy, because what happens is when you go to school in Georgia, K through 12, that's an investment that the state makes in you. We make an investment in every single child that goes to public school in our state. And we invest all of these dollars into these students, and we raise them up all the way to 12th grade, and then we basically tell them, you're no more a resident than someone who lives in Arkansas or Alaska. And so that student very likely will choose to leave the state and find a school that will be that has better tuition rates, instead of keeping them here in the state and keeping that talent in the state. And so we are really doing a disservice to our state when we do this. But to be clear to your question, if you are a Black student, you can get that in-state tuition. So this is really something to, yeah. And if you are a Black student and you are a resident of Georgia, you get in-state tuition if you apply to UGA, Georgia Tech, Georgia State, or any of the public GE schools. But that is not the case if your parents brought you to the United States undocumented when you were a child and you went to school as an undocumented and then you applied for the DACA program, you do not get that same courtesy.
Okay. Now I'm going to turn my questioning over to Michonne, who is a host of Cutting Edge. Go ahead, Michonne. You have a question?
Okay, mine is a healthcare question.
Okay.
What can be done about physicians that have racial biases that give their patients of color inferior health care?
That's a really good question, and honestly, it's something that we have to address in our state. There have been surveys that have been done that shows that this implicit bias does exist. There are medical students right now that truly believe that Black people have thicker skin, they have higher pain tolerances, and they act accordingly. They choose their pain management for those patients differently than they would for a white patient who is having the same concerns or making the same complaints. That's a big deal. I think it also contributes to a higher maternal mortality rate for African-American women versus white women in our state. Right now, Georgia has one of the worst maternal mortality rates in the country. But if you are a Black woman in Georgia, it's even worse. And so that is something that, you know, that is something systemic. That's something that needs to be addressed, and we need to flesh out what's going on with that. And so I think what that really has to do with is education, and that really has to do with understanding at a very basic level, what are we teaching our students in medical school that this is what they believe when they get out and they're in residency and they are touching patients, they are speaking to patients, and they have these biases ingrained into their brain, and they use that, those biases come out in the way they treat their patients. And so I think it's going to come with more training. I don't know what we can do legislatively to fix that, because it's a mental thing, and you really can't legislate people's minds. And so we've really got to fix the education component of that, and that's something that I would love to address with our medical schools. We have amazing medical schools here in Georgia, and we need to address why this is still the case in 2020. When you survey these doctors or these residents, these new doctors, they still believe these things that are completely and patently false, and they use that in their treatment protocols.
Now, I'm going to like to take a caller, okay, that they wait patiently. 8051, you're on the line. Welcome to Black Earth America.
Good evening. And I am impressed with your guest. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Can you hear me? Okay. What I want to ask your guest is, are you a threat to the Republican Party by being so knowledgeable and in both areas?
Okay, so if I understand the question correctly, is that the entire question? So am I a threat?
Right, and I mean, yeah, because you know so much, and from what I'm hearing, you're also enlightening doctors and everybody else about a lot of different things.
Well,
so
I would say that I am definitely targeted by the Republican Party. They have spent a lot of money trying to unseat me from the seat in this particular election because they do not like the voice that I bring to the state legislature because it's a needed voice, and they don't want that. They want to keep things status quo. They want to keep it the way things are, and having someone that can speak knowledgeably about these things, that can stand up and stand behind what I'm saying with the science, you know, that is threatening to people. But that's not going to stop me from continuing to do what I need to do to represent all Georgians and represent them correctly and use the science and the evidence in my decision making. And so, you know, they have definitely targeted me, and they put quite a bit of money behind me.
That means you're doing something.
You know, that's the way I look at it. I feel like if I wasn't doing anything right, then no one would be paying me any attention.
Right.
But the fact that, you know, they see me as someone who is disrupting that status quo, they see me as someone that when I raise my hand or when I push my button to speak, that I'm about to come with some knowledge and I'm about to come with some power, they see that. And so, yes, that is threatening. But, you know, I'm not here to make friends. That's not why I got into politics. I got into politics because I believe that we need voices like mine in positions of power. We need voices like mine at the table. We need voices like mine to speak up for people like me and people like the ones listening to this radio show. We need those voices in the room. And for a long time, they did not want our voices in the room. And right now, they don't want my voice in the room, but that's not going to stop me.
Also, I have another question for you.
Okay.
With what Trump is put out in the media about the virus, what don't you agree with what he's telling us?
So much. I think that right now we're dealing with a pandemic virus right now. And the problem with the pandemic virus, especially SARS-CoV-2, which is the virus that causes COVID-19, the problem with this virus is that it is moving fast and hard, and it is causing all types of damage in all types of different ways. And honestly, it's hard to keep up with it. And so what we, the people, are dealing with right now is what I deal with in the lab, and that is the scientific process. And understanding that science is a process and that sometimes what you think is going to happen or what you think is happening, sometimes you get it wrong because when you do a little bit further study, you realize, no, that's not exactly right. And so one of the things that frustrates me sometimes is, number one, that as soon as something sounds like it's a good headline and something that will get you to click on an article, people will run with it. Instead of really taking the time to understand that you can't make conclusions so quickly when there's still so much that we don't know. But here is what we do know about the virus. Number one, we know that it is a virus. Number two, we know that this virus is not like the flu. There are some similarities to the flu in that they both, influenza is a virus that that goes into the respiratory tract, and so is COVID-19. But the manifestation of COVID-19 is not the same as the flu. We also know that some people, just like with the flu or just like with anything else, some people get really, really sick and some people even die. And then some people get milder symptoms and they're fine. And we also know that there are people who are asymptomatic. But whether you are asymptomatic, have mild symptoms, or have severe symptoms, we also know that you can spread this virus to other people. And so that's what's really important for people to understand. I do think that, you know, dealing with a pandemic for 8 months in a society that is used to things being in 280 characters and less than 30 seconds, people are bored with it. People have decided that, you know, they're tired of taking the necessary precautions because, you know, they're just tired of being, you know, at home, or they're tired of wearing a mask, or they're tired of not going to see their friends or going to the club or going to a concert. They're tired. And so I anticipate that what we will see, and unfortunately what we are seeing right now, is an increase in the number of cases and the number of deaths and the number of hospitalizations going into the fall and winter months.
And it says that since we're going into the fall and winter months, everything's going indoors where the virus live. And also I've been hearing that the next six to 12 weeks are going to be some rough weeks.
It's true. It is true that we are in a situation right now where we are starting to see the numbers turn again in the wrong direction. We've had some peaks, and we've had some horrible peaks, and we've had some valleys where we thought we were making some progress, but no valley ever got all the way down to where we needed it to get. And every time we see, it seems like we're starting to make some good progress, something happens and that trajectory turns in the opposite direction again. And that's what's happening right now. You know, this is one of those things where, you know, I hope I'm wrong. This is one of those things where I would love to be wrong in this situation. And I would love for this virus to just go away. But even what we're seeing globally, I do not think that's going to happen. I think that we are going to see a reemergence as people get back indoors, and they also are ignoring that the virus is around us. I mean, I'm seeing it all the time. I'm seeing parties, no one's wearing a mask. I'm seeing, you know, people really just kind of throwing caution to the wind when it comes to the virus. And I think most people just kind of think it won't happen to me, or if it does happen to me, I'll be one of the lucky people that's asymptomatic or doesn't get that sick. And the problem with that is it's a gamble. You don't know. Even healthy people can die from this virus. You might be less likely to die, but that doesn't mean you won't die. And there are people who are sick and who you think would die, and they come out and end up being just fine. So it's really one of those things where it's not something that I would necessarily want to play Russian roulette with, but, you know, there are a lot of people who have kind of just kind of given up and decided that they're just going to live life and just hope and pray that they don't get it, or if they do get it, they don't get too sick.
Thank you, 8051, for your question. Now there's another caller, 0528. You're on the line. Welcome to Black Herb America.
Yes, this is Richard Shaw Kenny.
How you doing, Richard? How's everything, man?
Fine, sir. How you doing?
Okay.
I have a question for Dr. Clark. Dr. Clark, as far as the field of microbiology and molecular genetics is concerned, heaven forbid if we get out of this and we occur another virus attack of some other nature. My question, I guess, basically, is your field of study and the scientists involved, will that help us to return to homeostasis as far as patients are concerned much quicker, having a heads up and knowledge of how the viruses work?
You know, to be honest, I have said this a million times. We did not have to be where we are now if there were different people in charge. And I truly, wholeheartedly believe that. I do believe that this has awakened a lot of scientists and a lot of science voices and science minds to run for office. And I do think that if we do encounter something similar to this in the future, There are a lot more people, that science-minded people that are running for office that will win in November that will have a better gauge of how to handle this. I truly believe that, and we've seen it, countries that have leadership that put a big focus on academia and on the science side of things, they got through this a lot better than we did. And so, field of microbiology is extremely important. It's extremely important for dealing with a pandemic like this. And I really wish that instead of demonizing or instead of trying to write off voices of people like Dr. Fauci, who I have I've known Dr. Fauci. Dr. Fauci's been doing what he's been doing for decades. Even when I was getting my PhD, Dr. Fauci was in charge. So, you know, he is very respected, and to have him so dismissed, it's really sad, and it really speaks to where we are and where we could have been if we took voices like Dr. Fauci's a lot more seriously, and just science voices in general a lot more seriously when the virus first hit American soil.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Thank you.
No problem.
Thank you, Richard, for calling. Again, the number is 954. And press 1. We have the Honorable Dr. Jasmine Clark, Professor of Microbiology and State Legislator. Okay, I'll get ready to do another switch now, Dr. Clark. I want to discuss your HB 133 bill, which is where it has sex education, including the prevention of HIV. How would that be implemented in the school system, and what grades?
So right now we teach sex education in middle school. And so HB 133.
And what's middle school, like 5th, 6th, or 7th grades?
6th, 7th, and 8th grades. And HB 133 would not change that time frame. We teach different things at different levels. So we do teach in elementary school, late elementary school, I believe it's 3rd or 4th grade, we do begin to teach about understanding consent so that children who may be being molested or, understand that that's not normal and that should not be happening and they should let someone know. But we don't really teach sex education, the actual class sex education, until middle school. And HB 133 is asking for something very simple. Medically accurate sex education. I would like to see sex education treated as a science course and not as some type of morality or values course. And the reason why is because, as I told you earlier on this call, Gwinnett County is extremely diverse. And not only are we diverse in race and ethnicity, but we are diverse in religion. And so I do not believe that our sex education should be religion-based. Because everyone is not the same religion, and
so
in our public schools,
now?
It should be a separation of church and state, and so that should not be happening.
Yeah. So, what is currently sex education now in the public school? Is it morality based or religious based?
That right now, sex education is more instead of it being educating. You are educating our students about their bodies, about the changes that happen at puberty, and really truly understanding, like, you know, the sexual changes that are happening in their bodies at that time period. Middle school is when people are starting to go through puberty. Our kids are starting to go through puberty. Instead of that, right now the focus is mainly on preventing pregnancy. Pregnancy is just one part of what's happening with the body or what can happen with the body. And also because it is so focused on preventing pregnancy, it is also mainly focused on our female students preventing themselves from becoming pregnant by teaching them that their bodies are ruined when they have sex, and that no man will want to marry them if they have sex and things like that. And to me, that is just not what we should be teaching our students. Not in, no, that, I mean, those are things that you teach at home. That is something that needs to be taught in the home. We do not need to be talking about telling little girls that their body parts are ruined, their genitalia is ruined because of, you know, they started having sex with someone. And the reason why, even if that is what you believe, and even that if that is what you are going to teach your children in your home, again, we are talking about a course that is supposed to be a health science course. That ain't based in health. That's all subjective.
Well,
it's something that someone decided, society decided, and that's just not what we should be teaching in school.
Do you think sex education is taught in the home on the average?
I would say
that. Do you think parents know how to have those type of talks with their children?
Well, I was taught, and I would say, and I've had those conversations with my children, and I say in the home, and when I say in the home, I mean outside of the school. So, yes, it is true that there are some people that are not teaching their kids anything about sex, and those kids are learning it, you know, through the streets, through the internet, through, you know, their friends, all that stuff. That is definitely happening, but even if that's where they're learning it, if all you're teaching them is don't get pregnant, you are missing so many other things that should be taught to students. Abstinence-only sex education, while we should teach abstinence, is the only way to prevent things like STIs, STDs, and pregnancy. You know, we also have to understand that you cannot just tell people don't do it. And
when you have it all over the internet, and when you have it in every mass media show, you know, like that's almost like hypocrisy.
And that's what I'm saying is they're gonna do it, and at least if they do it, I'm not saying every child would do it, but if a child do it, I would rather a child enter into a sexual situation informed and not ignorant. One of I will never forget it. When I was younger, my best friend, she and I went to one of those festivals, one of those street festivals that they have, you know, in the summertime. And at the festival, we were young. We were in high school, maybe 10th grade. At the festival, there was a group just giving out condoms. And as a joke, she got one. She got one of the condoms and put it in her purse. And we didn't really, you know much about, you know, what was going on, but it was kind of a funny, it was a silly joke. Her mom found that condom. And when her mom found the condom, the reaction was, it was definitely brutal. But one of the things that happened after that, after getting in trouble for finding that condom, was she made sure to never, ever have a condom anywhere near her, on her person ever. And she was the first of our friends to get pregnant and, you know, and have to deal with some of the other consequences of sex. And I just remember it as being like scaring people out of doing something doesn't stop them from doing it, but it will make them not do it safely. And so I really think that, you know, we should really just, if we just start at medically accurate, if we start at biological, keep it biological, I think that we will equip our students with much more information and better information than saying don't have sex, sign this pledge in order to get an A. And there is evidence that in other countries that do have comprehensive sex education and that do inform their students that teen pregnancy is lower and development of STDs is lower. A lot of people worry that if you teach them, you know, about it, then they're going to want to do it. And my argument is naturally, because of their body, their hormones, their pheromones, they're going to want to do it anyway.
Right.
And so whether you teach it or not, that's already, that's intrinsic.
That's nature.
So inform them on how to do it safely, and inform them about the consequences, and inform them about consent, and inform them, you know, give them more information, not less information.
Right, be more open. Go ahead, Michonne. I know you have a question or two.
Okay, it's about the sex education in school. Does the school there, or do you feel that it's a school place to teach sex education? And the other question is, can parents opt out for their children? Say, let's say if they have different views from what the school is teaching. Like, say, for instance, if they teach, like, it's okay for somebody to be homosexual and things like that. And if you don't agree with that or anything like that, you know, you against that, you believe it's wrong, can a parent opt out for their children not to be, like, taught that? Because it, I wouldn't want my child to be taught something I don't believe in.
Yes. There is always an opt-out option for sex education. That has always been the case. And I do want to address the homosexuality thing, because I do think that sometimes people are like, I don't want school teaching my kid that it's okay to be a homosexual. A lot of times when we are, when you're dealing with, for example, a medically accurate sex education, it's not about teaching if something is okay or not okay. It is more so just teaching, again, what the body is going through, biological changes. We also try to make sure that we infuse that no matter what someone's sexual preference is, that people should not be bullied. And people should not be treated a certain way, harmed, because that is another thing that a lot of LGBTQ students do deal with at that age, is the bullying associated with, you know, their orientation. And so, but yes, if parents feel uncomfortable with that, then they can always opt out. But, yeah, when I think of comprehensive sex education, I don't think about teaching is this okay or is that okay. I don't think it's about teaching having sex is okay, period. Like, that's not the point of these comprehensive medically accurate sex education. The point is to get them to understand what's going on in their body, the changes that are going on in their body, the consequences of sex. And, you know, the ways to protect themselves from certain consequences of sex, should they, you know, should that happen, understanding what can happen if you don't do X, Y, and Z. And so, but yes, opting out is always an option.
Okay, and if they opt out, is there a replacement that they can get, or they just opt out and lose whatever?
They opt out. They go to the media center or something, like, during that time of the day. Go to the media center and go to, you know, somewhere else, study hall or something instead. But, yeah, they don't replace it with a different curriculum. There are actually parents of the current curriculum that is, you know, that teaches about kids being ruined and all that stuff. And the reason, and I tell the story because I think it's important for people to understand multiple perspectives, but teaching a child that they are ruined if they have sex could increase the likelihood that if that child is being harmed, if that child is being molested, that they won't tell anybody. And that is what has happened. We actually have stories of students who have withheld when they were being harmed because they were being taught and they did not want anyone to know that they were ruined. And so they did not tell that a family member was actually sexually molesting them. So, we just have to be really careful about the language that we use with our students, especially in middle school where they're very impressionable. And so that's why, again, my goal with my bill is to keep it science-based and take all that other stuff out of it.
Well, do you think this should be mandatory in the school system instead of leaving the opt-out clause in there?
No, I don't think it should be mandatory because I do think that it's a touchy subject. I mean, there are some people that just don't even want their kids to know sex exists. And even though, you know, their kids will find out one way or another. You know, I don't want to take that option away from parents. So as a, for right now, I am okay with the opt out option. But I also think that it's important that parents actually know what the curriculum is and what is being taught, so that if they are choosing to opt out, they're choosing to opt out for, you know, for specific reasons. They're at least informed on what is being taught and what their child will not be taught if they choose to opt out.
You know, I'm about to say something subjective. In 2020, you know, I find it very difficult to believe that you have parents. Well, we've been through the last 40 years of like HIV, the crack epidemic, understanding sexuality, various sexuality. Then in 2020, you have people really feel that they don't want their children to know about sex until they're 16, 17 years old. And by then, it should be too late. Now, I'm going to move away from that HB 133 bill and go to the Affordable Care Act. I'm going to return to health care now. Now, conservatives say, your people in the legislature say, that the Affordable Care increases taxes and high insurance rates. What is your response to that?
That is patently false.
Well, that's what they say. I wrote it down verbatim. That's what they say.
Yeah, and they're wrong, and they are not being truthful. People have to understand the way this works. The Affordable Care Act wasn't even enough, in my opinion, to make sure that everyone had access to affordable care, but it was a good first step, although it definitely had a lot of flaws.
I think it really dropped the ball.
Yeah, I mean, and I can be honest about that. You know, I'm not one of those people that you know, worships the ground that Obama walked on and felt like he could do no harm. I do understand that more should have been done, and I agree that more should have been done. But given the circumstances that he was under, and given how hard he fought for even a little bit that he got, I do appreciate that the ACA at least opened up doors for more people to get health care than that had it before. But in places here like Georgia, we did not expand Medicaid, and the reasons why we didn't, that expanding Medicaid was a provision in ACA that basically said you expand Medicaid to cover more people, and in the process of doing that, we will match the funds that you spend 90 to 1. So for every $10 that you spend, we'll give you $90. That comes out to about $3 billion a year, and Georgia literally turns that down. Every year that we have not expanded Medicaid, we have given away $3 billion.
And they give $3 billion right back to D.C., right?
And it's going right back to D.C. and being given to other states that did expand Medicaid. So when they talk about taxes, let me tell you what's happening right now. You go to work, you pay your taxes. You go to the store and buy a candy bar, you pay taxes. We pay taxes all the time in our daily lives. Those taxes are being paid already. But guess what those taxes are not doing? They're not paying you back. You're not getting a return on that investment. So Republicans, while they sit up there and say, we won't want to do this because it'll raise taxes, they're already taking your taxes and doing something else with it. Guess what they will not do? I promise you to this day, if the federal government offered a federal matching program to build another highway in Atlanta, Georgia, they will take that money. They will take federal matching funds for everything else. But when it came to taking federal matching funds in order to help Georgians have access to doctors, to be able to afford to go to the doctor, to be able to afford their prescriptions, they said no, cost too much. And that right there tells me that they feel like Rose asphalt is more important than human lives, and specifically the lives of working people, because that's who would have been covered by that Medicaid expansion. Working Georgians who are underemployed, people who are making minimum wage or just above minimum wage, they fall into this gap where they are not eligible for a lot of those subsidies that would make their health insurance be lower, but they make too much to get Medicaid. And so these Georgians are being left in the dust. And then the governor wants to come back with this Medicaid waiver program. Now, everybody knows what WAIVE means, W-A-I-V-E. That means to get rid of something, like something you don't have to do. You waive,
right.
Waiving your rights means you're giving up your rights. So we gave up something. And these waivers literally cover less people. There were 500,000 Georgians that fell into this coverage gap. The waivers only helped 50,000 of them. 450,000 Georgians are still left on the boat without a paddle. And, you know, and it's a slap in the face to Georgians, and it's a slap in the face to people who are really trying to help when they get up there and have these press conferences and laugh and rub shoulders and act like they've actually done something good. What they have done is horrible. There are still Georgians that are going to be affected. There are still hospitals right now in the middle of a pandemic in our state. Two hospitals are scheduled to close.
Right. I got another question. Hey, you said something earlier that triggered this question. If this justice get appointed, is Roe v. Wade in trouble?
You know, that's what they say, and I do believe that they will try. But the interesting thing about Roe v. Wade, the history on Roe v. Wade, is that Roe v. Wade was decided with a conservative Supreme Court.
Okay.
Roe v. Wade was decided by justices that were appointed by majority Republican presidents. And so, you know, it's very interesting to me that they dangle Roe v. Wade like a little carrot to drive out the vote in certain situations. I do think that it is under siege, and I do think that they will try to get rid of it. But the public sentiment, whether Republican or Democrat, conservative or progressive, is overwhelmingly that Roe v. Wade is decided and does not need to be touched.
Yeah. Well, I have one more question. Then I'll have the last question to Michonne. Will voter suppression happen this year in the national election?
Short answer, yes. There is so much energy right now and so many people wanting to vote. And the powers that be see that power slipping away from them, and they're going to try everything they can to suppress the vote. So that's why I'm encouraging people to vote early. That's why I'm encouraging people, if they vote by absentee, that they need to go ahead and get those absentee ballots turned in now. Turn them in now. Number one, so the USPS can't hold your ballot up and have it sitting in the post office when it should be at the elections office. Number two, if they try to reject your ballot for any reason, you can stop it. You can cure it.
They're being instructed to do that.
What do you mean?
Yeah. They're taking away several mailboxes. They're making it difficult for people to mail in. The head of the post office. It's a trumpeter. So they've been instructed to do that.
Oh yeah, they have. I feel those effects right here in my district. They took away all of our mail processors. So right now our mail at our post office, they have to hand sort everything. They took away the sorters. All of the mail. That right there, in the middle of an election, with the deluge of election mail, because Georgia right now is a swing state, it is considered a swing state, and we have two senators on the ballot, which means that our Senate race is on the ballot, which means that we really could tip the scales in the United States Senate. So in the middle of all that, they took away our sorters, and people are having to hand sort the mail. So, yes, it is an issue. Is a major issue, and it is something that they're doing. So that's why early is the key for this. Vote early. Get your vote in now, because they're not telling what they're going to try on election day. Get your vote in now. Turn those absentee ballots in early so that if anything happens, you have time to fix it. The thing about I love about absentee ballots is if they reject it now, you have time to what we call cure it and fix it before Election Day. So turn them in. Don't wait. Don't wait until Election Day. There is absolutely no reason to wait until November 3rd. November 3rd is the absolute last day, last resort day to vote. Don't wait till then. We have two more weeks. Get it done now. Get it done early. Have it be
and
over with.
Getting shorter.
Any shenanigans they try, it won't be fruitful.
And the waiting is getting shorter. Michonne, you got the last question. Go ahead.
Okay. Why do healthcare providers located within a majority of African American neighborhoods tend to offer low quality care?
I'm not sure about that one. I'm saying I don't know the answer to that one. I guess I'm not really familiar with that being an issue. I will say, however, and this is just thinking about it economically, in certain areas that are more low income, more people are on Medicaid, and Medicaid pays out to providers a lot less than private insurance does. And so I wonder, and this is just me wondering or hypothesizing, I do not have the actual answer to this, but I do wonder if there is a correlation between, you know, the quality of care and, you know, the amount of money that is coming into that office. Also, dealing with uncompensated care, a lot of offices are kind of running in the red or having to, you know, make ends meet. But to be honest, I do not have the answer to that question. And it's not something that I could necessarily speak on legislatively. If that is an issue, then I would definitely love to address that with doctors to really understand what the issue is. I guess what I'm saying is that's not an issue that's really been brought to me by my constituents. So I didn't really haven't really thought about that one. But that is a good question.
Okay.
Dr. Clark, I thank you for coming on the show. I thank the callers. I thank Michonne always for being my co-host. And it's really been very enlightening and informative, Dr. Clark, having your presence on the show. And I really
thank you so much for inviting me. I appreciate you all.
Okay. And good luck on November 3rd, Dr. Clark. You will win again.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
All right. That's another week, ladies and gentlemen. Michonne, what you going to discuss tomorrow?
I'm the same thing from last week, but part two. I had a lot of people contact me and said I didn't give enough time. An hour wasn't enough, so it would continue.
Okay, part two, Black Man Roll of the Family. I thank everyone. Everyone have a good night. Thank you, everybody, for listening on your laptops and your questions. Again, I thank Dr. Clark. Again, another week. I am because we are. We are because I am. Good night, everyone.
Hold it now.